Next, conflict of interest. If the contractor leads the design-build team, you have a terrible ethical dilemma. What happens if you see something on the project that's wrong, or at least bad, even if not wrong? Your only real option is to go to the contractor and tell him about it, because he's your client. He's hired you. And the contractor may or may not listen to you. It's up to whatever is driving or motivating the contractor. So the owner may never hear about things that are desperately in the owner's interest, and you'll feel guilty and actually unethical letting that go. And if you do go over the contractor's head to the owner, you're probably breaching your contract with the contractor that calls for issues of confidentiality and communications and things like that. It's a horrible ethical dilemma that has been one of the reasons that contractor-led design build has gotten a little bit of a negative reputation in some circles. But if you are the prime design builder, the communication is yours. You go to the client with whatever you want to go to the client about, or whatever you keep from the client, whatever you don't think the client needs to know. And you have no constraints on that decision-making. You make the decision yourself. Cost discipline. How many times have you heard contractors derogatorily complain about architects that they can't design to a budget to save their lives? Classic complaint. Well, I can't tell you if it's true or false, and it's truer for some than for others, and sometimes not, but not in architect-led design build. If an owner ever questions your ability to design to a budget, the answer is, I'm guaranteeing the budget. If I don't design to it, it comes out of my own pocket. Not only can I design to the budget, but I'm guaranteeing to you that that'll be the result. So it's a real easy answer with architect-led design build. And finally, financial capitalization. There is the criticism of architect-led design build is that you're hiring a design firm, and what good are they if there's a problem? They don't own anything. There's nothing, except for their professional liability policies, there's nowhere to satisfy an owner's liability. Well, the answer is that the construction liabilities are ultimately satisfied by a general contractor, just as if the contractor were the lead. If there's a construction defect or problem, the ultimate source of the payment for that is the general contractor or one of his subs. If you don't have a general contractor, if you have multiple prime trades, you'll find them pointing at each other like this, leaving you to hold the bag. When there's a general contractor, it doesn't matter which trade screwed up the other. It's ultimately the general's problem, and he has to sort it out with the trade contractors. Now the advantages to you. They fall into four categories. The first advantage is additional profits. This is by far a more lucrative, profitable style of practice than what you're used to today. And the extra money does not come from the owner's pocket. It comes from the efficiency of the process. And let me give you some examples. First, the markup on the construction cost. As we talked about earlier, you're going to be able to get, I can't tell you it is 5%, that's what my clients have been charging on residential and light commercial kinds of projects, for your construction phase, which is a huge increase over what you're getting now. Another source of extra profits is savings. That if there's any kind of efficiency on the project, I always thought this was a travesty. If a traditional project comes in under budget on a GMP contract and there's a savings clause, it's divided up between the owner and the contractor. You never get to participate, even though it may be your input that had major things to do with coming in under budget. You don't get any share of that. Here you do, which is a total source of windfall profits to you. A third source of additional profits is reduced labor costs. And this is part of the teaming arrangement. As you get used to design build, you'll find that you don't create your documentation the same way that you otherwise would have. For example, instead of extensively detailing the drawings, by the way, I call that defensive detailing. Do you understand what I mean by that? It's not because the contractors truly need that level of detail to know what to build, but they need it in order to forestall them from claiming ambiguities and the rights to extra compensation. That's wasted effort. If the contractor weren't a claims contractor and were your teammate, you wouldn't need to spend the money on all of that detailing. Instead, if there were any kinds of questions you need resolved, you call the contractor and the relevant sub and maybe even a vendor into your office. You sit around a conference table, you work it out over 30 minutes, you write up a memorandum of that meeting, and that's the detail. saves a tremendous amount of CD phase labor. And that savings in labor is extra profit. You will find, well, I won't say that for you, but my clients are finding that their average profit per project is being multiplied more than five times based on when they're doing this kind of structure. And, you know, theoretically, it could even be more than that if they with a lot of savings. Marketing advantages. We talked about the ability to guarantee the construction price and how that's putting your money where your mouth is. That's a tremendous marketing advantage that no other architect would have. The ability of the owner to delay the design-build decision is another wonderful marketing tool that you can tell the owner that he doesn't have to make this decision now. He should work with you as an architect for a few weeks, get comfortable with you, make sure he's got the confidence in you before converting to design-build. Nobody but you, as an architect-led design builder, can make that offer to an owner. We talked about the contractor becoming a source of work. That's another marketing advantage. All of a sudden, you have a new source of client that you didn't have before. And it occurs to me that there's another one that I didn't put up here, but that's the ability to offer a discount on the architectural fee. Because after all, you don't need to charge the owner for the bidding and negotiation phase or the construction phase, which is usually about 25% of your total fee, more or less. So you can promise the owner a 25% reduction in your architectural fee if he hires you to do it design build. And of course, your design build company makes sure that it gets an appropriate overhead and profit through the price on the construction. And that's how, that's a tremendous sales tool to, especially to an owner who's looking to look good with his board of directors or something, or who's particularly cheap and trying to minimize fees. You know, we don't know any clients who like to do that, do we? Control over construction. This is what's emotionally satisfying for most of you, I believe. That as an architect, your role has been marginalized over the years. I blame myself, or at least I blame lawyers. You know, since World War II and all the GIs came back and went to school on the GI Bill and continued through law school, we've had a glut of lawyers in this country. And they're looking for new niches in which to practice. One of the ones they got into in the 50s was construction law. Did you notice that architect liability happened to mushroom in the 50s initially, when before that it really wasn't a major problem? You can ask yourself why that may be, and please don't be too harsh on my profession. But since then, we've been giving you what I think is lousy advice, necessary but lousy advice. We've been telling architects to back away from portions of the project that have liability attached to them. Don't get involved in means, methods, or procedures. Don't make warranties or guarantees on the project. And what's happened is that many architects have marginalized themselves almost right out of the market, to the point where interior designers and program managers and construction managers and even general contractors have muscled in on territory that was traditionally architects. It's a short-sighted way to react to the liability crisis. The better way to react to the liability crisis is to exert the proper kind of control over construction and get rid of the adversarial relationship with the contractor that's the cause of so many problems. Here's an example of how you control the construction project. HVAC system you've designed. And your engineer, or you, if you have the capacity in-house, has specified a particular HVAC model. And when you hire a contractor and you're doing value engineering or whatever, this is traditional construction we're talking now, the contractor talks directly with the owner and says, hey, they over-engineered the system. You can save X dollars in capital costs by reducing the quantity or quality of the system in this way. And of course, he doesn't share the life cycle problems or anything like that, or the potential dangers on the margin. The owner, who has dollar signs in his eyes, says, great, wonderful, we're trying to cut costs, this is a great opportunity. So you go ahead and you design and build the project that way, and you've sealed the mechanical drawings along with your mechanical engineer, and lo and behold, the mechanical system has problems. It doesn't function adequately. You probably all remember the State of Illinois Center that Helmut Jahn designed. I was Helmut Jahn's lawyer for that piece of litigation, so I've got lots of familiarity with a process that screws up an HVAC system's design. But in any event, the contractor gave the owner ultimately bad advice, or what you believe was bad advice. And once the owner had that bug in his ear, there was nothing you could do about it. In designer-led design build, with the architect as the lead, the contractor doesn't talk directly to the owner without your consent. The contractor talks to you, gives you the idea of whether or not to cheapen the HVAC system, and you say yes or no based on your judgment, not his. So you develop a control over the project you wouldn't otherwise have. As a construction contractor, you can inspect the project. If the contractors ask you questions about means, methods, and procedures, how do we produce this particular detail, and you know, you can tell him without incurring liability as a design professional, because it's not your design firm that's answering the question, it's your design build company that's a non-professional. The flip side of the coin is if you've screwed up. Suppose there's a structural error, you've undersized a beam. No one knows until it's delivered to the site, and then it's obviously undersized. The contractor calls your attention to it right away. What happens on a traditional project? On a traditional project, it's a PR disaster. The contractor goes to the owner, points out the idiocy of the structural design, says the architect doesn't know what he's doing, and makes you look bad. On top of that, he seeks a change order, and he's entitled to it. And that change order has big prices by the trades, big hefty markup on it, and it's difficult for you to prove that it's overpriced, and you're liable for it anyway, so the owner has no incentive to reduce it. So the change order is some big number. What happens in architect-led design build if the same undersized beam is delivered to the site? Well, the contractor never goes to the owner. He goes to you, and he points out the problem, and you decide whether or not to share this with the owner. In this case, there's no need for the owner to know. You're going to make it right. So there's no PR problem in the first place. And the contractor is on your team. He's not out to screw you on the change order. Instead, he's going to go to his subs and negotiate the best prices he can get from them. He may even get them to waive profit or something like that on the change order, and he'll bring you a change order which is a much smaller number than in traditional construction. Because if he were to try to build it up and take advantage of you, you'd probably never award him the next job. It's one of the advantages of architect-led design build. So even in situations where there is liability like that, you can reduce that liability by having the contractor as your teammate and by maximizing damage control on the project. Now, of course, he expects you to do the same thing for him. If he's painted himself into a corner where he's out of options and is about to have to do something that's expensive, he's going to ask you to try a design alternative to help him out of his mess. And it's in your interest to do so. Even though you're spending time in the office helping him redesign in order to avoid the problem, it's to your advantage because 50 cents of every dollar he loses is coming from your pocket. So you're actually actively helping each other, and you can imagine how that makes the litigation and the claims on the construction project go away. Now, here's the part the liability companies, the insurers, refuse to believe. Reduced liability for architects in architect-led design build. First, construction accidents. What happens today? The construction worker's hurt. He hires some ambulance-chasing lawyer who sues everybody on the construction project, not knowing the difference between an architect and a contractor. You tender the claim to your professional liability carrier. They defend you. I might be the lawyer defending you if you're in Illinois, and I'm going to win the case for you. I might even win it on summary judgment, but I can't win it cheaply because I have to sit through discovery and all that. It's going to cost you either all or a significant portion of your deductible to win that case. In architect-led design build, you're out of it for free. When your design build company gets sued, because that's the only company active during the construction phase, you are insured under the general contractor's general liability policy. And you simply take the summons and complaint and give it to that insurance company, and they have to defend you, and it doesn't cost you anything or any deductible. If you were doing this as an architect rather than as a design builder, they wouldn't have to defend you because there's an exclusion in these policies for professional services. So they'll say, sorry, it's a professional liability claim against you. We're not defending. And in most states, they'd be right. So you cut the liability for construction worker injuries down to essentially zero when you practice design build leading the team. Claims for obvious design omissions. In the teaming agreement, there is a provision that says The contractor is every bit as familiar with the construction documents as the architect is, and will be reviewing them and proofing them as part of the takeoff procedure. So if there's an obvious facial omission or error that's clearly obvious on the face of the drawings, the general contractor agrees not to make a claim for it. You leave a door off a door schedule. You show a water fountain, but no piping leading up to it. The general contractor does not make a claim against you for it. He's got to absorb the costs. But of course, for every dollar he absorbs, 50 cents comes out of your pocket. So you basically eliminate all the minor claims and things like that that turn a construction project into a war zone. And finally, cooperative resolution of design problems. We talked about this a moment ago. When you undersize the beam, you cooperate to resolve the problem, and the ultimate final cost is less. The bottom line is that you have no greater liability in this structure than you do today, because the extra element of liability, construction, is something you pass through 100% to the contractor. And there are these three areas of design professional liability that you eliminate or reduce. So you have less liability for architect-led design build than you do for traditional architecture. And finally, the sources of your fee, or I could also title this, why the contractor wins with efficiency in this kind of structure. Well, first of all, I don't know if you're familiar with statistics. When I was with the Design Build Institute of America, its then current president used to work for a construction design build firm and had accumulated some statistics that I can't tell you are true for the country as a whole, and I can't even tell you they're totally true today. But about 10 years ago, she told me that her design build construction company broke down their profit margins for three different kinds of jobs. These are gross profit margins, overhead and profit combined. For typical hard bid, sharp pencil jobs like public works, they got an average gross profit of 2.5%, which wasn't enough to cover their fixed costs and wouldn't be profitable work if that's all they were taking on. For their traditional negotiated projects that were not competitively bid, they were averaging 7.5% gross margin, profit and overhead, which was wonderful, and they were perfectly happy with that. They could have stayed in business on that forever. But for their design build jobs, they were averaging a gross margin of about 12% because of the efficiency of the process, eliminating the things we're going to talk about in a little bit. And that additional margin between 7.5 and 12 is available to be shared with you. Now, I've heard in the years since that the market has tightened up somewhat and the profit margin may now be in the 10% range, gross profit. But still, that's a huge extra profit compared to negotiated jobs. Now, where do those extra profits or savings come from? On this slide, marketing overhead. Contractors spend a lot of money to market for their jobs. They take people out to dinner, they take out ads, they put up displays, all kinds of things. And that money, in an accounting sense, is spread as overhead among all their projects. Not for architect-led design build. They don't market or spend money to market to architects. You give them the project. They don't even know it's out there until you put it in their laps. So they don't have to spend any money for marketing on architect-led design build. That means that the money that was for a normal project that they'd spend marketing isn't spent and is available as extra profit, which can be shared with you as part of your markup during for construction. Cost analysis. I've always been blown away by this. You know, the average contractor wins one out of every three or so jobs that it bids. That means that the jobs that it wins has to absorb the overhead of three estimates, because two of them aren't going to get paid by anybody because they didn't get those jobs. So two-thirds of the estimating on any particular job is wasted overhead. But in architect-led design build, that doesn't happen. If the contractor provides pre-construction services and estimates the job, either the contractor gets that job, or as you recall from the design, from the price schedule guarantee, the owner agrees to pay for the cost of the estimating so it doesn't come out of overhead, it's reimbursed. That means that two-thirds of the overhead item in the of the estimating overhead for any particular typical job is eliminated in architect-led design build, and that eliminated margin is available to be shared with you as extra profit. Bidding, pricing, estimating. You ever been in a contractor's office when they're bidding a job? It is a nightmare. They have 3 or 4 weeks. They have all kinds of things to do to get proposals and find vendors to understand design intent. All kinds of mistakes are made during the bidding process, partly because of the rushed nature and partly because they have to glean your design intent from your documents because you're not sitting there telling them what your design intent is. Not an architect-led design build. In architect-led design build, they're in your office during design development in the CD phase. They know design intent as well as you do. They know exact, not only that, but they're inviting their subcontractors and vendors into your office to give you hard and fast proposals that can be accepted, so there really isn't any room for error in understanding what the costs are going to be. And the margin of error that they have to build into their bids for estimating problems is virtually eliminated, or cut to the bone at least, on architect-led design build. So cutting that overhead out as well leaves additional profit to be shared with you. But the primary source of the efficiency, of the extra profit that's available for you to earn, is the absence of adversarial administration. You know, only a lawyer could have designed modern construction. Lawyers who do trials where the prosecution and the defense fight with each other. Today, construction, at least in a lot of cases, boils down to a fight between the architect and the contractor. That's idiotic. That's not how construction ought to be. Construction ought to be a cooperative process where each supplies the expertise that the other doesn't have and where they work toward the most efficient resolution of a situation. Here's an example of non-adversarial administration that's nobody's fault. In a traditional project, substitution issue. Your documents probably call for the contractor to seek approval of substitutions long before doing that part of the work. And they never do, of course, because they haven't figured out that aspect of the project yet. Instead, they ask you for the substitution when they need it in a hurry because they're about to order. And they ask you, and you say, well, I don't know. You've got to send me the catalog cuts and information that I need to evaluate it. So they hurriedly throw together the catalog cuts and send it to you. And it probably answers 90% of your questions, but I'm sure there are some extra questions you have that they didn't think to anticipate. So you have to talk to them or call suppliers or whatever it may be. By that time, you've spent so much time on it, duplicating their investigation, and the window of opportunity may have passed. That's a ridiculous way to plan substitutions on a project. How should it be done, as it is an architect-led design build? As soon as the contractor has an idea for a substitution, he calls you on the telephone and says, I've got this idea to save us some money. Let's talk about it. And you call them into your office, and the general and the subcontractor and the vendor in question meet with you. Maybe one of your engineers, if it's an engineered item. And you talk about it. In 15 or 30 minutes, you figure out if it's going to work or not, and you enter a modification, a change order, or whatever you want to call it, to the construction requirements, and it's done. And it's done quickly and with minimal cost. It saves tremendous amount of money, time, and effort. And that's the smart way to do construction. So even though I'm a lawyer and I benefit when construction projects dissolve into litigation and everybody's fighting with each other, as a professor of architecture, I'm telling you that's not the way it ought to be, that there's a better way to do things. Now, I keep a website, and people are free to contact me, that's got all of this information plus a lot more. And I have a bunch of cards up here for anybody who's seriously interested in trying to do this. Feel free to take one. There's also this article for people who do a lot of public sector work, because there's a different twist due to the competitive bidding requirement for public work that makes this be structured slightly differently. And this article is really aimed at public officials who do this kind of thing. I've used up almost all of the time that I have available. So I'll take questions now, and I will remain after the time to talk to any of you individually. Question?
Yeah, some clients think that the architect should be their sole advocate, so that's the question. That's A plus B. B is some people think the contractors take an inside profit from the subs.
Question is, Some people think that the architect needs to be their policeman and that contractors are taking undue profits. There are easy answers to both. As far as the architect being the policeman for the project, we all know that that doesn't work very well, that you're not able to police a project when you're there once a week or once every other week. It's really a fallacy by the owner. If he wants to have somebody else as a policeman, he can hire a consultant, but there's a better way to do it. The better way is by thorough programming. You should work with the owner to develop a program to such a degree of thoroughness that if you meet all of the elements of the program, the owner is by definition happy. And when the owner is happy, there's no problem. And as for the contractor sneaking all kinds of profits, there's no reason you can't do this on an open book basis, where you bid out the subs or you show the contract, you show the subcontracts to the owner so that he sees that almost all of the money is going into the trades. There's no secret profit here. Question?
You mentioned that the owner has the freedom to take some time to think about it before he goes into the architect-backed design construction phase. Do you have some timetable there that may allow for inflation over time?
The question is, how long does an owner really have to decide? It looks like, just a moment, it looks like I've run out of cards here. I will be around and give everybody website information and things like that. But the general rule is the earlier the better. The earlier the owner decides to go to design build, the more creativity the design build team has to meet the program objectives efficiently and creatively. If the owner decides late in the CD phase to transfer this to a design build job, you know, all the work at that point's basically been done. It's not all that different from a traditional job. Question?
Well, first I want to compliment you. You've done more for the profession of architecture today in an hour and a half than the AIA has done for us in the last 100 years.
Thank you.
I'm not trying to undervalue what the AIA has done for us, but you have absolutely given us the power back, which somehow or another we have lost through all of our contracts. And my only other suggestion was, if the AIA has not already adopted your contracts and not put them online, why not? And
well, let me answer that. The question is, why hasn't the AIA adopted a series of contracts like this and made them available to everyone online? To be fair, this is a relatively new concept, not design build or even architect-led design build, but reinventing it after the contractors dominated the market for so long. It's not popular with the industry as a whole. I used to be the chair of the Professional Practice and Contracts Committee of the Design Build Institute of America. I don't want to say I was drummed out of there, but they do not like this because that's an organization that's dominated by contractors. And although it's an excellent organization, they do some very good work, they're not in general in favor of architect-led design build. And as a result, the prime pusher of that in the industry really hasn't been behind it. But I'll tell you that if the AIA came to me and wanted help to draft this, you know, my partner, Paul Lurie, has been affiliated with the AIA Documents Committee for many years. We would gladly help.
My firm's doing a lot of design build projects right now. The contractors and our groups are all about stuff. We're seeing better alternatives to conventional hard bid adversarial approach. We also see that we're missing out on some opportunities. So, again, I commend you for being able to say it.
Thank you.
It really is a better approach, but I'm a little unclear on exactly in this approach, when you convert one agreement to the other, at what point, you know, does the fee transition over, and how do you keep that line clear? So that the,
it's a good question.
You're not incurring the professional liability that we're trying to look at.
Sure. The question is, really, when do you transition from one of these steps to the next step, and how do you handle fees and compensation while you do that? Well, there's no one right answer to that. In different people can develop it differently, but my recommendation is that you transition, the best time to transition from traditional architecture under your B-141 to the design build proposal is probably early in the design development phase. There's nothing, you know, every project is developed differently, but that's late enough that the program and scope are fairly clear, yet early enough that you're not locked into design decisions that might otherwise not have been chosen had you been working with a contractor. As far as fees go, throughout the design phases, you're working on your architectural fee, period. You get paid for that, and if you may or may not waive the fee for your construction phase and bidding and negotiation phases. And then the construction contract is not a fee-based contract. It is a lump sum contract. Whatever fees you have are worked in as part of markups in the lump sum, which means that whatever you've waived in like construction phase architectural fees, you can make right back up and more in the lump sum contract.
In the states, we have statutory retainage. This kind of agreement, who holds on to it? Who holds that
nut? That's a good question. I think I'm vaguely familiar with the retainage laws. They vary from state to state, so I can't give an overall answer. But to the extent that retainage is an ownership concept, the owner withholds it from you in your lump sum contract, and as it gets released to you, you release it to the general who releases it to the trades. If it is merely between a general and subcontractors, then you can pay it all to the general who withholds it from the trades, and you're perfectly protected. It's easy to work out. It just isn't an obstacle. There was a question here.
Yeah, we've been using the term general contract throughout this entire discussion. Is it adaptable to a construction manager?
Excellent question. Question is whether the concept of a general contractor is adaptable to a construction manager. And the short answer is yes, if it is an at-risk construction manager that's holding the trade contracts, which between you and me, legally, is almost the exact same thing as a general contractor. And in fact, you've put your finger on the difference between public and private construction. Public construction requires the general contractor to be a CM so that the public owner can contract for CM services, which are professional, rather than needing to do competitive bidding.
Under your model, the architects, consultants, engineers, and so on, under what format or what contract do they perform their construction administration type services?
Does who perform it? The architect you're asking about?
Yeah,
sure. Essentially, the construction phase services could be absolutely identical to what you do today. You have a general contractor that's fulfilling the contractor's functions, so you don't need to be providing a higher level of services. So the structural engineer will provide essentially the exact same services that he would today, except that he would be working then for your design build company. It's the only difference. It doesn't change anything. Was there a follow-up?
Well, then isn't your design build company starting to get into providing professional services?
You know, the question is, isn't the design build company providing professional services then? And the answer is no, not really, because the very same set of services could be defined either as professional or non, despite the fact they look the same. I mean, take a construction superintendent hired by that works for a contractor and a job site observer for an architectural firm. They both review pay requests. They both observe the construction for conformance to the documents. They both review submittals or are involved in the submittal process. They're doing pretty much the exact same things from different angles and for different purposes, of course. But for one, the services are non-professional, and for the other, they're professional. So the definition or the line between the two really kind of breaks down for construction phase services. It's not clear. You do not need two contracts. All you need is a construction contract which promises as the contractor, the design builder, to deliver the final product. The second contract, the one that calls for traditional...
Between the structural engineer, so you differentiate between professional services and non-professional services.
All that the architect really has to do is to assign its subconsulting agreement with the structural engineer to its other division, and it's the same contract. Yes.
Well, and this is kind of related, but in that case, how does a professional architect head a non-professional firm and not still be liable just under your license?
Good question. How does a professional architect run a non-professional construction company without becoming liable under your license? The answer is it's done all the time. How many architects don't practice architecture but what run construction companies? It's not the license that makes you liable, because all that the license regulates is your practice of architecture. If what you're doing is practicing construction, your liability comes from your construction contracts, not from the license. So the fact that you happen to be an architect is really irrelevant. It doesn't change your legal status at all.
It's a service you contract to provide.
That's correct. It's a service you contract to provide. Becca?
If this potential employee goes out in the field as a part of the construction and they get a paycheck from your architectural firm, are they acting as a professional in the field?
Another very good question. If your employee of the architectural firm goes out into the field as an employee of your design build company, who are they really working for? Well, you know, I didn't have time to go into the accounting details of how you set up the two corporations. But what you do is you have an employee lending agreement between your architecture firm and your construction company, where in exchange for lending employees from one to the other, the construction company pays the architectural firm for them from the profit it earns on the construction. So you need some bookkeeping entries to make it work, but it's nothing terribly complex.
Quick question. Does the architect-led design-build company have the bonding capacity?
The architect-led design-build company does not need bonding capacity and rarely has it because it's a paper shell company. If an owner requires a bond, then the general contractor puts up the bond and names the owner as an additional obligee. And because the general contractor's scope of work is exactly the same as the design build company's scope of work, namely all of the construction, that bond covers all construction, and your professional liability policy covers all design.
Great. What corporate structure would you recommend for the architect design build?
I recommend the following corporate structure for the architect design build company. That'd be exactly what your architecture firm is. That's the easiest way. Owned by the same people in the same ratio, so you don't care where you take profits and losses. I'm being told to wrap it up here on the taped part.
What's your website? My
website is, first of all, I have an email address up here. If you email it to me, I'll give you my signature back, which will have the website on it. But for those of you who are, you know, it's so long to give it to speak it that it's probably better just to email me and let me give it right to you. I'll be very good about that. And I'm going to stay here even though they've stopped recording and talk to whomever of you have any further questions. Is it up there?
Yeah, it's up there. The main name of your email.
Website is your email address? The Schiff Hardin
website? Well, schiffhardin.com is the overall URL. You can get to my website from there by looking me up. But it's easier just to email me. Oh, are they good?
I have a question.
All right.
On your website, could you post your address?
Thank you.